to another edition of the Security Ledger podcast. I'm your host, Paul Roberts, the editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. Back in the 1990s, the term crypto wars was used to describe a tug of war between the technology and intelligence communities in the United States and Europe over the export and use of strong encryption technologies. The U.S. military and intelligence services were convinced that letting strong encryption technologies fall into the hands of our enemies would dull the U.S. military's technological edge and possibly make it harder to spy on our enemies. These days, there's a new crypto war heating up as intelligence and military officials in the U.S. and U.K. call for the inclusion of so-called backdoors in applications like WhatsApp that use strong encryption to secure users' communications, even as lawmakers in the EU debate whether to ban such backdoors. Our guest on this week's podcast, Richard Moulds of the firm Whitewood, says that a much bigger challenge looms for all users of encryption tools, namely the lack of robust random number generators that are used to create unique cryptographic keys. At the root of the problem, Moulds says, is a lack of reliable entropy or disorder from which random numbers can be generated. While earlier generations of multipurpose computers had plenty of ways to sample randomness, from measuring mouse movements and random audio samples to keystrokes, modern computing systems are much more often clones of one another, spun up in Amazon, Microsoft, or Google's cloud without any inputs or accesses to sources of disorder and randomness. The same is true of Internet of Things endpoints, which are often single-purpose devices that generate and traffic in very small amounts of data. Weak random number generators mean weak and predictable keys, and those open the door to motivated hackers guessing the value of an encryption key as part of an attack. In this podcast, we talk about the critical role that entropy and randomness play in securing the internet, and about how the advent of the Internet of Things is likely to bring about a crisis in randomness as more and more devices need to communicate securely over the internet, but grasp for enough randomness to generate strong encryption keys. I started by asking Richard to talk about how one goes about measuring randomness and whether there's a way to determine whether a particular random number generator is random enough.
That's always been one of the challenges with random numbers. I mean, first of all, how do you sort of measure the difference between two numbers and declare that one is random and one's not random? You know, if I said the number 42 and the number 67, how could you possibly tell which of those was a random number and which one wasn't? So retrospectively, right. taking a number or taking a key even, I mean, if in the world of cryptography, you know, if we could manufacture a bunch of cryptographic keys, measure their randomness and throw away the ones that weren't very random, then you know, this problem would go away in a heartbeat. But unfortunately, you can't, because you can't retrospectively test for randomness, because then, you know, any combination is a legitimate result. To understand randomness, you have to understand the whole process. You know, the actual physical source of randomness that goes into the algorithm and how the algorithm works and how these keys are generated. You sort of have to see the thing from soup to nuts, which is what makes it a challenge in a sense, because if you think about sort of most computing, you know, the computing environments we live in today, it's sort of a stack. You know, somebody owns the hardware, somebody might own the hypervisor virtualization layer or containerization system, somebody might own the OS, somebody might own, you know, either middleware, you know, an e-commerce platform, for example, and somebody might own the application. Very few people have visibility of the entire stack, and that's fine, you know, 99.9% of the cases, because in most cases, you know, folks can just focus on the things that they are responsible for. You know, in these, as you said, in the environments we use today, everything's highly abstracted. We like the idea of applications running anywhere without any knowledge of the hardware that they're running on or the physical environment they're in. We like to think we can move our applications in and out of clouds, you know, around our own data center from one box to another box, and it makes no difference, because that yields the, you know, the elasticity and the flexibility and scalability that we need in modern application environments. But entropy and randomness is one of these things that pervades the whole stack. You sort of have to know how it all works, and that's the challenge in measuring it. You know, if you think about a security officer, you know, that security officer might not even know where the crypto applications are running, or even how many copies of those instances are actually running at any given point in time. Never mind what physical platform they may be running on and what entropy sources may or may not be available for each individual platform. So it becomes sort of the great unknown. So thankfully, NIST have been working recently, the standards body, on some new standards for at least measuring the statistical randomness of random numbers. And they are talking about launching actually a certification scheme for entropy sources to be used in generating random numbers that could then go on to be used for cryptographic keys. For a long time, there's been a set of standards for certifying the security of crypto applications and crypto algorithms and such like. But even those standards have dodged the issue of testing and validating the entropy in a system, the randomness in a system. So hopefully NIST will plug that gap in the next few months, even with some standards work. And at least then we'll get a benchmark of which systems are deemed to be able to generate sufficient quality random numbers to be used in cryptographic systems. So that'll be a big step forward. But even then, using these standards will still be quite a fine art, in the sense that you'll need to apply these tests and measures, fairly low down in the stack, literally in the depths of the operating system. This is not something you can just do the application layer.
Okay. So two kind of basic questions, and then we can talk about getting at random.com. Just for the listeners, random numbers are really a foundational element of encryption and secure communications on the internet. So for example, TLS, transport layer security, secure sockets layer, the technologies that give you that little padlock on websites that you visit that show you that your exchanges or interactions with that site are encrypted, at least in transit. Those use random numbers underneath the generation of that encryption key. Is that right?
Yes, I mean SSL TLS is a great example of our reliance on random numbers. I mean, obviously there are keys associated with encrypting the traffic that moves over the network. There are both certificates associated with authenticating the two ends of an SSL connection, and then there are session keys that are created to actually encrypt the traffic between those two ends. So, for example, an online retailer will have a public and private key pair, a certificate to prove their identity to browsers that connect to that server, and that's a long-term key that is shared across potentially hundreds of web server images and virtual machines that represent a website. Very few websites, of course, run on a single physical box. They might run on hundreds or even thousands of virtual machines. So each of those virtual machines will share a common private key that is used to prove the identity of that website. And of course, that key really does have to be a special key. That's a key that you might buy from a certificate authority, for example, somebody like the Symantec. So that's got to be a very trustworthy and clearly a highly random key. And random numbers obviously form a critical part in generating that key pair. But also the keys that are used to encrypt individual sessions between each of those web servers and each of those browsers or phones or whatever they might be, millions of connections a day potentially. Each one of those sessions has a unique encryption key generated for that session. And obviously that calls upon random number generation. And then even the protocol, the SSL protocol to do the handshakes and agree all of these keys and set up the system, if you like, set up the secure channel. There are various other, they call them nonces and vectors, initialization vectors to create that channel. So establishing an SSL connection, might use a dozen long random numbers, some of which are user keys and some of which are just used as part of the protocol to establish the nature of the channel. So a fast web server handling internet e-commerce traffic will be consuming megabits per second of random numbers, believe it or not.
And in this case, on the consumer end, the laptop or mobile phone that's initiating the connection to that website, they would be using local sources of entropy to participate in that exchange. Is that right?
That's right. And that's the IoT problem. You see, if you've got, say, you've got a million gas meters, drones or driverless vehicles or whatever they might be, and connecting back to the mothership, the transit authority or the DOD or the gas meter, the utility company, you know, those devices are all using SSL to connect back to that mothership to either relay, you know, the gas meter reading or to receive a command to open a valve or do whatever. So the keys that encrypt that traffic, you know, are being generated on those IoT devices, which then, of course, brings into question, well, how able are each of these IoT devices for generating high-quality keys? And if you've got a population of, you know, 100,000 gas meters, what's your confidence level that all of those 100,000 meters can generate keys of equal quality? Of course, you wouldn't expect them to generate the same key, but you'd certainly expect them to have an equal ability to generate decent keys. You wouldn't want to believe that the device is running on the old version of the hardware was somehow inferior for generating keys, because if that were the case, of course, the attackers would know which endpoints to go after. In fact, there was a release of firmware by Siemens for a bunch of their building controllers over the holiday period. It's just gone because it turned out many of those devices were all generating the same keys. There was some research done at the University of Pennsylvania to prove that a variety of IoT devices from dozens of different manufacturers were actually generating, you know, essentially the same keys because they had insufficient supply of entropy in those devices.
So the devices were so identical that the key they were generating were basically the random keys they were generating were basically the same.
Right, and as you said earlier, you know, it's about sort of sterility. You know, if you're building chips or you're building devices or you're laying out a data center or you're building a cloud or whatever, generally speaking, you want things to be the same. You know, you want the chips to be identical. You want all those racks and racks and racks and racks of servers. You want to be the same. You don't want weird, crazy hardware. You don't want variations between devices. You want stuff to be predictable, which, as I said earlier, you know, in 99% of the time, makes perfect sense until you get to the issue of generating random numbers, in which case you want those subtle variations. You want to believe that 100 devices don't do the same thing. You know, when you go to Home Depot and buy, you know, that your new front door lock off the shelf, you want to believe that each of those door locks are all different, you know, and they don't all have the same key in each of those locks. You want to believe that when you and your neighbors go upgrade your front door locks, you don't all upgrade the same key. But you don't know, you don't check.
We don't generally test it, no.
Right, and it gets even worse in virtualization because what we like to do, of course, to have highly scalable systems is we like to have a golden image of our application. We take a snapshot and then we replicate it, you know, tens, hundreds, even thousands of times across multiple instances. Of course, when we do that, we're replicating the state of these PRNGs, these pseudo random number generators. So we're copying the RNG as it is right now on one golden image, and we're replicating it all 1,000 times, which means we now basically have 1,000 random number generators that are all in sync. So now the question is, how quickly can each of those VMs capture sufficient local entropy to start to diverge, to be reseeded, to start generating their own unique random numbers? Because we want to believe that not only is each device able to generate a random number, but we want to believe that all the devices are independent of each other in generating random numbers. Because if that's not the case, of course, then we give the attacker a huge leg up.
And on that point, Richard, just sketch out for us, why is this such a big deal from a security standpoint? How is it that attackers are able to exploit weak or non-random numbers to launch attacks?
Well, it really just comes down to combinations. You know, if you have a two-bit key, of course, the idea of a two-bit key would be crazy, but with a two-bit key, there'd be four combinations, 00, 01, 10, and 11. And if each of those four combinations were equally likely, then, you know, the attacker could make four equally likely guesses at the key. But if it turned out that those four combinations weren't equally likely, say it turned out that 11 never showed up and 10 showed up three times more often than 01, you know, I guess the digital equivalent of loaded dice, you know, in Las Vegas.
Right.
Then it means the attacker has fewer guesses to make in order to guess the key. So we think about a key as having, you know, for example, in the context of AES, 256 bits which in principle yields 2^256 combinations of key. But if it turned out that there weren't really 2^256 combinations of key, it means that we might be using a 256-bit key, but we might have an effective security of, you know, who knows, 110 bits. We tend to measure the security of our crypto systems by how many bits are used in the key. But if the effective security, the effective randomness of each of these keys is less, then we might be kidding ourselves in terms of how secure our crypto systems are. Because, like I say, if an attacker wants to break cryptography, it's all about the keys. It's not about the algorithm. The algorithms are, you know, are not secret. The only secret in the system is the key. And the whole premise of cryptography is that these keys are secret. So if an attacker, because as soon as they're no longer secret, then obviously encryption falls away, or digital signature falls away, or the authentication can be broken in a heartbeat. So the security of crypto systems tends to be all or nothing. Either the key's secret and everything's safe, or the key's not secret and nothing's safe. So an attacker can either steal the key or they can guess the key. Now, given that we spend, you know, what is it, $100 billion a year or something on IT security technologies, you'd like to think that stealing keys gets harder for the attacker every day. You know, the security industry in general gets smarter and makes it harder for the attacker to steal keys. So stealing keys should get harder. But guessing keys, almost by definition, gets easier because the attacker has access to faster and faster computers every day and will one day get a quantum computer. So the issue of guessing keys is really the issue that we're dealing with, because that's the issue that is really is pivotal on this notion of entropy and randomness. So what's interesting is people will say, you know, very proudly, hey, I just upgraded my encryption system from AES 128 to AES 256. When you ask the question, that's great, what did you do to increase the level of entropy in your system by that much? They say, well, nothing. Okay, so you doubled the number of keys in bits in your case. You didn't take any steps to double the number of bits of available entropy in your system. And in fact, you probably now run an environment where you reduce the amount.
How do developers access entropy? I mean, how much knowledge is there of the relative robustness of the of these various tools that they're using to put encryption features into their applications?
No, I mean, varies, varies tremendously by operating system. But if you think about Linux, for example, Linux actually illustrates the point very well. So there are two standard system calls into Linux to get a random number. So if your application wants to generate a key, say OpenSSL or something wants to generate a key, it requests a random number from Linux. And there are two commands to do that. One is called devrandom and one is called devurandom. So almost every application out there that runs on Linux uses either devrandom or devurandom to get access to a random number. And the difference between the two, I think, makes the point and answers your question. So the U in devurandom means it's unblocking. So it will always give you a random number, irrespective of how much randomness that particular copy of Linux thinks it's managed to capture. Whereas devrandom is a blocking interface. So if Linux, this particular instance of Linux, doesn't believe it has enough entropy to generate a decent random number, it will block. It will refuse to give you a random number. It's a safety measure built into Linux to say, hey, I can't give you a random number because I don't have any entropy, or I don't have enough entropy. And Linux is keeping a constant score of how much entropy it has gathered over time. And, I mean, you can debate how good or bad it is at keeping score, but it keeps the score. It has this thing called an entropy pool, and it maintains a count of how much entropy it thinks it is in this entropy pool. If it has not enough, then it blocks on dev random. It will always give a number on devurandom, irrespective of how much entropy is in the system. So
right.
The analogy I often use is, you know, it's like having two taps, faucets in your kitchen. You know, one is guaranteed to give drinking water, but will run dry if the water is not drinkable. That's the equivalent of devurandom. And the other tap is always going to gush water, but it might not be drinkable. And that's the moral equivalent of devurandom.
Right.
So, I mean, so, you know, Linux does the right thing. It has a safety measure. It understands what entropy is. It measures it, and it applies the safety measure to its pseudo-random number generator. The problem is, of course, you know, on most systems, devrandom is dead. You know, there is insufficient entropy, and devrandom is basically useless, which means every application developer, you know, surprise, surprise, will choose to use gave you Random because it's the only one that's guaranteed to be available. So we're essentially drinking poison to quench our thirst.
And why is DevRandom dead on so many systems?
Well, because it's insufficient entropy. You can ask Linux what it thinks is its current entropy score, and when you do that, it's surprising how low the figure is. And literally, if you just build a little application to pull random numbers from DevRandom, in most cases, it's dead. It's not working. It's stopped because there's no entropy in the system.
Okay. So Whitewood is on this problem. This is a problem that your firm dedicates itself to, and you've launched this new service called getnetrandom.com. Tell us just a little bit about how it works. You say it's a free quantum grade entropy for the use of everybody, I guess.
Yeah, it's a public SaaS offering, cloud service. So we have a high speed entropy generator. We actually use quantum mechanics, which is the cool stuff, I suppose. Quantum mechanics is, if you believe your Einstein history, is the only source of true randomness in the universe. So quantum mechanics is truly unpredictable. So we use a quantum mechanical source to generate literally gigabits per second of perfect entropy. And then we make that available for streaming online to pull into a virtual machine, IoT device, anything that wants to request entropy. That entropy is, in the case of Linux, deposited in this entropy pool. So essentially, we make DevRandom work. We make DevRandom always available because the operating system always has sufficient entropy to generate a random number. So we essentially make DevRandom and DevURandom the same. They're both permanently available and they're both true random number sources. You don't need to deliver very much entropy over the network. I don't want to scare people by sounding like we're streaming megabits per second of entropy to an IoT device. You only need hundreds of bits to reseed a virtual machine or a device, even a device that's consuming megabits per second of random numbers. So this is really, think of this as like a background service. Think of it almost like a utility service. An analogy might be, network time protocol. You can't trust in an individual server or a phone or a laptop or a VM or whatever it might be to know the time of day. So you have a central, high quality source of time, and then you essentially synchronize everything over the network. We used to program our phones, if you remember, 15 years ago, we'd program our phone with the time of day and our laptops and our servers. We don't do that anymore. We just assume everything knows the time, and it does. In the same way that you can't trust something to know the time of day, you can't trust something to generate sufficiently good random numbers. So we deliver entropic seeds over the network to make sure that all of those devices and all those virtual images can generate true random numbers. I sometimes think about it as almost like a flu shot for servers. We are essentially inoculating IoT devices and server instances from making crappy keys.
And when you say you're streaming entropy, what does that entail? If you were to look at the entropy, what would you see?
It just looks like random numbers. It's just of perfectly random data. There's a small agent, a Whitewood agent, that sits in user space on the device, in the virtual machine, on the laptop or phone or wherever. It monitors the amount of entropy in the system, in the operating system. And then when the operating system needs more entropy, it literally requests packets of random seeds from the service. They're delivered over the network. That entropy gets delivered into the entropy pool of the operating system, whether it be Windows or Linux. And then Linux just generates better random numbers. So any application doesn't even know we exist.
So what is your source of quantum entropy? I imagine some glowing orb in the middle of a clean room that's like pulsating with light or something like that.
Actually, it is, believe it or not. Yeah, it is. A lot smaller than I think you envisage. But it does use light. It actually uses a quantum mechanical effect called photon bunching. So you generate quite high power light and the degree to which these photons can actually bunch, it's an interesting phenomenon. It's been known about for years. We didn't invent the phenomena. Arises as a purely random signal that you can sample and turn into digital numbers and deliver them as random bits.
That is very cool.
So yeah, that's it is, and the technology was actually invented at Los Alamos National Lab. So this is a this is actually the fruits of many years of government funding, generally into the space of quantum computing and quantum crypto. And one of the spin-outs from government research into quantum crypto and quantum communications was a method of generating very high-speed quantum entropy. And what we've done is we've essentially licensed that technology from Los Alamos, and we've productized it into a piece of hardware that we can use as the source of entropy for delivering, you know, potentially to thousands of devices or VMs across the network. So I think we sort of solved two problems. You know, how do you generate sufficient entropy to seed an entire data center or an entire population of IoT devices? And then how do you get it into those devices so that applications consume it without needing to be changed?
Often in security, there are these kind of endemic problems that get ignored. And then there's, you know, to use the, you know, virology analogy, there's an outbreak of some kind, you know. So with insecure IoT devices, we had the Mirai botnet that, you know, allowed people to see the problem, endemic problem of insecure, you know, DVRs and IP-enabled cameras and so on. Is weak entropy on all these devices a similar type of lurking problem, or is it something that's unlikely to coalesce around a single incident or attack? It's just something we need to kind of work on over time or beat back slowly, but it's never going to blow up in our face.
It's one of those sort of lurking problems. As I said, there's been quite a lot of research. So this University of Pennsylvania work has spanned multiple years and has named and shamed dozens of device manufacturers for having poor quality keys in their systems. There was a sort of shockwave across the industry 2 years or so ago when NIST, National Institute of Standards and Technology, had to withdraw a random number generator algorithm because it had been proven that the algorithm had been consciously weakened.
Yes, this is part of the Snowden leaks, yes.
One of the things we learned from Snowden was that there was a weakening of the random number generator. And I think what that shows us is that, you know, organizations that want to weaken crypto and introduce potential backdoors, the random number generator is a preferred point of attack because of this issue, you can't retrospectively prove randomness. You know, if you literally had two servers on the desk in front of you, and you knew that one of them had a weak RNG in it and one didn't, you wouldn't be able to tell which was which. So in a sense, it's the perfect attack. Now, if you're able to weaken the entropy source or a random number generator in a server, then nobody would ever know apart from you. So I think it's sort of unlikely that we might read a news story saying, hey, you know, device or website cracked because of weak entropy, because whoever's in a position to do that is unlikely to ever talk about it because they will have realized the perfect attack. So I think this is a proactive issue that we have to address. You know, this isn't like most of the rest of security where we can look out for alarms and we can spot bad behavior, you know, and we can try and, you know, bring down the shutters after something bad's happened. Entropy and randomness is one of these things you sort of need to address up front. You just need to ensure the system has sufficient entropy because you can't retrospectively test for it. And I think that's why NIST have finally bit the bullet and decided to come up with a certification scheme for entropy sources. And eventually that, I think, will find its way into the certification schemes for crypto systems. So the most famous, most well-known, perhaps not the right word, most well-known crypto certification scheme is FIPS 140. And a lot of IoT devices, particularly, you know, anything that's dealing with sensitive data, anything that might relate to privacy, and obviously anything that might relate to, you know, critical infrastructure, will need to be certified to the FIPS 140 standard. And when I think the new entropy standards come out, they'll likely become part of this FIPS 140 standard because they essentially create a bedrock for, you know, all crypto certification. So I think it's one of these things. It's in some ways it's a housekeeping thing. You know, it's a sort of standard of due care. If you're running sensitive crypto apps, you ought to be thinking about where do your keys come from, where's that entropy coming from, to what degree are you confident that there's sufficient entropy in your system, And as your DevOps people move your apps around, you know, to different environments and pick, you know, their next favorite cloud vendor to host their applications, you know, to what degree are you sure that your assumptions around entropy are still valid? In most cases, there's no way to find out, you know. As I said earlier, how many security folks really know where their applications are running, you know, on what platforms they're running, what physical chips do they have access to? You know, almost nobody knows that stuff. That's in the realm of DevOps and infrastructure management. So, you know, we're essentially trying to get away from that risk by enabling, you know, security folks to say, every time you deploy to web server, you know, deploy the ability to access a known and certifiable entropy source so that you know that all those SSL keys are of sufficient quality.
Richard Moules, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Yeah, most welcome. I enjoyed it.
Is there anything else that you want to say that I didn't ask you about or give you the opportunity to say?
No, I don't think so. It was great.
Okay, great.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That was great. That was fascinating. These are the type of topics I like talking about. They're
yeah.
You know, complex important.
Sure, but I was amazed with the SANS Institute. They did a keynote at the ISA show, and every year they forecast what they think are the 7 most dangerous attacks for the coming year. And this year they posted weak RNG as one of their 7 most scary attacks.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think on the back of this this Siemens sort of urgent security patch, which made the point that, hey, you know, because I think University of Pennsylvania, I think they identified 30 companies, and I think Siemens were the only ones that went public with this thing.
Right.
So that means, you know, there's millions and millions of requests out there.
Right.
That, you know, I mean, the whole point of cryptography is the number of combinations. Means that the odds of any 2 keys on the entire planet being the same is infinitesimally small. And yet, University of Pennsylvania, I think, came up with, I'm guessing the figure, something like 3% of the keys are the same.
I remember that story. Which
defies all of our assumptions of cryptography.
Yeah, right. Either we really misunderstood the math, or, yeah.
Right. I mean, the whole point about Bitcoin is the chance of any 2 Bitcoins being the same, having the same public and private key pair associated with them, you know, because if they did have the same, then they would both be provably of the same value and the same thing, which completely destroys the notion of Bitcoin.
That's right.
Bitcoin rests on the notion that you could generate Bitcoins forever and never generate 2 Bitcoins that are the same. And yet, in the absence of entropy, it starts to look like there's a distinct chance that you might generate 2 Bitcoins that are the same. And what does that mean?
It tends to undermine the value of Bitcoin.
Well, you know, and blockchain in general.
Yes, right.
Bitcoin. But I mean, the whole premise of cryptography is that collisions are impossible and that guessing is infeasible. So as soon as collisions sort of are possible, in fact, we have examples of collisions. And, you know, actually our assumptions about the guessability of keys, you know, are false. Not that these things are easy to guess, but they're at least not, you know, impossible.
Impossible, right.
I mean,
right.
That's the central tenet of all this of crypto. And,
right.
You know, without crypto, there ain't no IoT.
Right. Right. Well, and you have, you know, motivated and well-funded adversaries who are, you know, are capable of pushing the limits and making that theoretical exploit actual. So that's
right.
Part
and then
of,
you have
that's
the whole issue. Yeah. Then you have the whole issue of quantum computing,
right?
Of course, well,
right.
You know, quantum safe algorithms. A lot of effort right now to come up with quantum safe algorithms.
Right.
You know, the quantum safe algorithms consume way more randomness than classical crypto algorithms, and of course the bar for their randomness is even higher.
Right.
So, well, you know, if you're building a data center now, chances are at some point in its working life we'll run a quantum safe algorithm. You know, chances are if you're deploying an IoT population now, chances are some of those devices are still going to be in operation when somebody in the world has a quantum computer.
That's right.
And that horizon is 8 to 20 years.
Right.
So a lot of these IoT deployments are easily going to span 10 years.
Yes.
So if you're worried about quantum computing, even if you don't think it's going to happen tomorrow, which is clearly not, chances are it is on the horizon for most of the time frames that so-called next-gen data centers and IoT deployments, have to worry about. So it should be part of your planning horizon, even if it's not something that you think the current applications should suffer from.
Richard, thanks so much for talking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
You're welcome. Pleasure, as always.
We were speaking today with Richard Moulds. He's the general manager of Whitewood Security.